Part 4. The Retail Experience. What does it mean to have and display a consumer attitude? It means first perceiving life as a series of problems which can be specified, more or less defined, singled out, dealt with. It means secondly believing that dealing with such problems, solving them, is one's duty. It means thirdly that for every problem already known or as may still arise in the future, there is a solution. A special object or recipe prepared by specialists, by people with superior know-how, and one's task is to find it. Zygmunt Bauman, 1990. Health is wealth. Orientation begins in a drab corner of the second floor yoga room at the Whole Foods on the Bowery. We sit at little rolling desks, our intro packets and pens smartly in front of us like we're about to take a standardized test. There are 12 of us new hires, a heartwarming range of ethnicities and ages, everyone channeling the first day of school, nervous and glancing and slightly overdressed. If I had to guess, I'd say we're all less curious about what we'll be required to do on the job, earning our then industry-leading $11 per hour, and more about what in that work could possibly require 2 days of classroom-style instruction to instill. This is the Whole Foods new employee orientation. It's the third and final stage in the hiring process, though completing it successfully, we're reminded frequently, does not guarantee us a place on the team. There have already been 2 phone interviews, an in-person group interview replete with role-playing, a background check, and now this, a 2-day, 12-hour orientation into the mission and philosophy of Whole Foods itself. But to actually become real live team members, I'd be working the fish counter, we still have to make it through a 3-month probationary period, after which our coworkers vote on whether we should be brought in a more permanent capacity. Passing the probation vote requires a 2-thirds majority in which each team member fills out a skills sheet, anonymously ranking our abilities. This is a great thing, we are informed by a chipper, green-haired human resources manager, because it'll help you understand where your weaknesses lie. Jury, a young man I recognize from a previous group interview because he didn't speak much English and relied on me to unreliably translate crucial moments, walks in. Hello, Benjamin, he says. Will you do the same thing? I give a C between clenched teeth, not wanting to give off the impression to the surrounding Whole Foods managers that one of my weaknesses is an inability to sit still and listen. Then Andy, our trainer, wide-eyed, ginger-beard, takes the floor. Welcome, 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 he begins with a cheer that verges on rage. I am so excited to welcome you aboard. This feels a little off since we were just explicitly told we weren't officially on board anything yet and we wouldn't be for quite a while, but the force of Andy's cheer, plus the knowledge that we can be let go at any moment, causes everyone to lean forward and put on their best smile. Jury looks side to side, then follows suit. I started here just like you as a part-time cashier, Andy explains. Now I'm leading trainings, all in 2 years. It's a type of position that at other companies might take 5 years to get to. Andy stops. What I'm saying is that at Whole Foods, you have a future if you want one. If you work for one. At this, the green-haired human resources manager waves us a friendly goodbye and departs. We're alone with Andy, who shouts a few more greetings at us and then dives headfirst into an icebreaker. Andy tells us to partner up. One person is asked to talk continuously for 3 minutes, while the other person doesn't speak at all. It is supposed to teach us active listening, as well as serve as introductions. But almost immediately, the human resources manager pops back in, Andy gets pulled out of the room on some errand, and the 3 minutes grow to 10. We are never told to switch partners, and so with half the room ordered not to speak, the other half utterly exhausted from being ordered to speak continuously, everything gets awkward. There's mumbling, then total silence. Finally, Andy pops back into the room and says, okay, wrap things up, to a room where most people are staring at their desks, necks hanging like narcoleptics, before adding without a drop of irony, unless you're in a heated discussion. He then fiddles with the PowerPoint for a moment, and we begin. The rest of the morning is a blur, less for reasons of speed or overwhelming information than for the concussive effect of repetitive, dull content. We are given a charmed version of the Whole Foods story, learn that it was founded in 1978 in Austin as Safer Way, quoth Andy, now that's really sarcastic, I love it, by John Mackey, a quote, conscious capitalist. Andy doesn't mention whether we should receive this epithet with sarcasm as well. That it survived a vicious flood in 1980, opened just 9 stores between 1980 and 1992, and then went through a rapid period of growth that led to our present moment in winter 2015 with 427 total stores and a new Whole Foods opening every 8 to 10 days. It is a lecture that alternates between extolling the greatness of Whole Foods as an organization and extolling our greatness for being selected to interview at Whole Foods. At one point, we take an actual moment of silence to marvel at this combination of our good fortune and Whole Foods discernment. You are here. Think. Think about that for a moment, Andy beseeches us. He stares off to the side, giving our thoughts the necessary space to expand, and I can almost feel him counting to five in his head before barreling forth. At some point, we turn our attention to customer service. We learn about the seven different types of difficult customers, a sort of late capitalist version of Snow White and her dwarves, featuring angry, whiny, hysterical, very important, the chatterbox, the know-it-all, and Mr. Multitasker. We learn that we must treat these challenging guests with respect because it costs six times more money to attract a new customer than it does to keep an old one. And because, above all, Whole Foods is in the business of saving money, phrased here as efficiency and linked heavily with the mission of being green. Footnote. The conjoining of efficiency and green becomes a leitmotif throughout these sessions and serves as proxy for both the central tenet of Whole Foods, the organization, writ large, and the subliminal message being whispered to each Whole Foods customer, writ small, namely that by serving yourself, you're also serving humanity, that it is only a lack of ingenuity and concern that prevents us as a species from having it all. All meaning honoring Mother Earth while eating really high-quality squash in the specific sense, but which in the general sense is more about the life we deserve as intelligent, well-intentioned Americans living in 2020, where gratitude and giving back are two of the many things included in the concept of abundance we've come to demand from both our lifestyle and our grocery store. End footnote. From there, we learn that Mr. Green is the Orwellian name for the Whole Foods internal security team, and that if we see something shady, we should head directly to the loudspeaker and page him. An undercover security detail will swoop on the scene and pounce on the troublemakers. This is followed by a crash course in the modern organic movement, which is shockingly, even movingly for a cynic like me, nuanced, calling out the idea that organic does not mean healthier, but rather is an option to pay extra to limit the externalities of production, and which focuses on unsexy aspects of organic, like soil conservation and groundwater runoff, rather than borderline falsehoods like nutrient density and/or the overblown pesticide claims that we could use to upsell customers. This moment of integrity is ruined the next minute by a bumbling lecture on GMOs, including a weird aside where Andy puts up the ingredient list for a non-organic, probably GMO, box of cookies and says, "Your body's going to have to work a lot harder to break down all those ingredients with long names," as if there were a relationship between linguistic and gastric digestion. Everyone, including Jory, nods along in appreciation of this information. Then a lecture on landfills and recycling, or the greatest thing we do, Andy says, where we are told that it takes 1 million years for a single glass bottle to biodegrade. When I get punchy from the boredom and point out this is clearly not true, vis-a-vis beach glass that seems to get eroded on a days to weeks timescale, Andy handles me, the know-it-all, with deft customer service charm. Huh, I'll have to look into that. Important point. I want a wink from him, but Andy never gives in. He's incorporated customer service into his entire being and charges on to tell us that recycling is good, not just for the environment, but for business. 4 cents per pound for compost and recycling compared to 10 cents for regular rubbish. Footnote. Sad, but totally predictable note you already know in your heart. Recycling in practice at Whole Foods and every other grocery store I worked at for this book was entirely and hopelessly fucked. I don't care what corporate claims or the rhetoric at the training, trash at the fish counter got placed liberally in every bin, less the result of apathy, more from the blitz of the job slash day. This was true of employees and customers alike, and inevitably, each night, most of the bags from the blue recycling bins would be taken and placed in exactly the same landfill dumpster as the bags from the gray, non-recycling bins. End footnote. He goes on to list other efficiencies the store prioritizes, from freezer insulation to lighting fixtures. Efficiencies that, above all, save money. I wait for it. Wait for it. Then suddenly, "Health is wealth," he exclaims to my relief. "Health for the planet, wealth for the store." We break for lunch, and I excitedly use my employee discount card for the first time, accidentally ingesting 1.5 hours of salary at the hot bar. My coconut milk hokey was tasty, but I decide I'm better off brown bagging it from now on if I want to actually earn money on the job. Then it's back to the yoga room for a role play around food safety. I partner with Jewelry. We largely stare at each other, my Spanish not up to the task of translating grease trap. In the middle of this, Jewelry's future supervisor walks to the door. He calls to Jewelry in Spanish, beckoning him. There, at the lip of the door, while the rest of us pantomime various food safety violations, the two have a long conversation of the type that looks actually instructive. Jewelry runs back in the room and gets a pen to write down information. I learn later that the supervisor specifically chose Jewelry to work the very same overnight grocery shifts that he, the supervisor, first worked 10 years ago when he began at Whole Foods, when he also spoke almost no English. And despite the banality of our training, despite the hours of Whole Foods hype, I flush with the magic and possibility of these low-wage, low-skill grocery jobs, jobs laboring to create a myth of abundance for all the high-wage people with high opinions who populate Whole Foods on the Bowery by day, and how there might actually be a path to this abundance, how Andy's cheer and rage might be the very mechanism of the American dream in action after all. Soon, thereafter, my brain buzzing on this notion, day one dead ends into a thick packet of forms we are told to fill out while a video in the PowerPoint plays, featuring all sorts of eager faces who climb the ranks to become management. The next day we return to do it all again. I'll skip the blow-by-blow except to say by hour 5.5 on day two, I look up to see that we're on slide 27 of 145 of the PowerPoint and I want to cry. Unlike day one with our icebreaker, we've opened our mouths perhaps twice. The mood of the room is about what could be expected, bored twitching, except Jewelry, who despite understanding not a word, stares with wide-eyed intent directly at Andy, his face a mask desperately conveying commitment. Then, somewhere in the mid-30s slide-wise, it is over. We are given name tags, told they are all important and that we must never come to work without them, and sent on our way. Our department supervisors will call us within the next week and will come in again. This time, to actually learn something about groceries. 8 a.m., and I'm greeted by my supervisor, Ali. He's a big dude, friendly, and built like a wrestler. As a supervisor, Ali will prove nearly flawless, kindly, flexible, reasonable, and completely absentee. I see Ali on the floor only on the rarest occasions, when he gets tipped off someone from Whole Foods Central might be floating through the store, or he wants to try some new type of promotion, like shucking oysters in-store or filleting a whole fish as a demonstration. Beyond those moments, he largely stays up in a second-floor office ordering product and fiddling with the schedule, tending to logistics we are neither privy to nor is he willing to describe, only fluttering down now and then to call us boss and make sure the display case is beautiful. Accordingly, Ali hands me off almost instantly to a deputy, a supervising team member in the nomenclature of Whole Foods. Walter is a scrappy guy, slightly balding at 27, trim as a piece of copper wire, and all smiles and endless energy. He bounces around our section in knee-high rubber boots and a thick vinyl apron, straightening shelves, collecting garbage, and wiping up stains with unconscious action. Walter has been working seafood for 6 years. He hates it. He hates the smell. He hates leaving encrusted with fish guts. He thinks it's destroying his love life. But he is finally crested to a point in the pay scale where he's not going broke while working, so wants to stick it out. It's also important to note that Walter is 100% upbeat about this hate. He was selected well by the Whole Foods hiring squad, and hence has an irrepressible, smoothed-out version of Andy's caffeinated enthusiasm that makes everything that comes out of his mouth feel cheerful, no matter how black the actual subject matter. Walter guides me to the back of the fish counter. From here, standing on iron-grated platforms that boost us up an extra 3 inches to serve slash loom over our customers, Walter runs me through the basics of cutting, weighing, and washing. The product slopes down and away from us. It sits on a plastic mesh designed to resemble ice, which itself sits on the crushed ice from this book's metaphorical beginning. The fish counter is a world of constantly melting and pooled water. Every inch of the stainless steel dappled, every square foot of floor streaked. There's a definite funk, but the smell is for the most part the smell of clean. Of clean, not actual clean. That wet mix of industrial strength soap and chlorine you'll find in old folks' homes that lets you know on some chthonic level the place is absolutely crawling with buggies. Smells aside, the work is simple. We have two primary missions. Serve the customer, fill the case. Serving the customer is self-explanatory, but primary. Anytime, anywhere, no matter what else we may be doing or thinking, if a potential Whole Foods customer needs help, we are to attend. Footnote. At the fish counter, this service is equal parts ballet and crisis. You take the fish in gloved hand and hold it aloft for the customer to see. Then whirling around to the back, you slice a chunk, amazing yourself every time that there is a hidden human skill for estimating weight from volume that you intuitively develop within hours of working with fish. Then you pop it on the giant gray scale to verify your intuition was indeed within a few ounces of the request, which it almost always is, then rip off a big old piece of butcher paper. If you're me, this is where the crisis begins. I'm one of those dysfunctional left-handers who never properly learned how to use scissors in elementary school, and who feel almost genetically incapable of either budgeting the amount of wrapping paper for a given gift or folding the subsequent swatch into anything neat and orthogonal, and therefore have spent an entire lifetime handing over presents that are both endearing for the obvious amount of labor and scotch tape involved and puzzling for the sheer ineptitude of the result. During my time at Whole Foods, I never get it. Often my results are so out of whack with the clean and expert Whole Foods image that I lose sales. Perfectly good fish that upon presentation in a clusterfuck of butcher paper isn't really needed after all. End footnote. Filling the case is the background activity we return to when customers are not around. It's the sole command Ollie barks on the occasions we see him. The fish counter relies on volume to project freshness, so any moment we're without customers, we race to the back freezer and grab new fish to fill any gaps on the ice. To do both these missions, we use box after box of vinyl gloves. They are consumed by our hands, almost like air that we breathe, constantly putting them on, ripping them off, the plastic skin becoming as familiar as our own. When the two primary imperatives are satisfied, the case is packed tight with fish, there are no customers in sight, we fill out the cracks in our time with tons of smaller jobs, blasting the plastic tubs with hot water so they don't stink, flooding and then squeegeeing the floor so it doesn't stink, picking out expired mussels from the stands so they don't stink, and if all else is finished and there's truly nothing left to do, perhaps using a handheld thermometer to check the case and enter food safety data into a log. But truthfully, excepting my first day when I'm taught this is a very important thing we do, I can't remember ever seeing it done again. With Walter's guidance, it doesn't take long to realize that more than anything, we're maintaining a mortuary here at the fish counter, keeping all our skinned friends looking glam for the customer. We retrieve their corpses from the back and then begin coaxing some semblance of fresh or life out of them. Time, oxygen, and room temperature are our enemies. Techniques range from endlessly repositioning them, slicing tired, flabby pieces into nugget-sized chunks, or, when things get really bad, the fish mortician's makeup of cut lemons and squiggly halos of sliced red pepper. It turns out each supermarket department has its own version of this cosmetic work. In produce, where I do a brief stint for a Whole Foods competitor, we pick at moldy blueberries in their carton, smearing the white fuzzy fungus against our pants, before moving on to the next one. Here, the command is pack it in rather than fill the case, and there are intricate rules about how to stack the cucumbers, with the dark gray end out, versus bananas, letting the ends cradle each other. Instead of refurbishing the fish, we pluck melons just on the verge of rot and take them into the back room, where a woman who speaks no English stands all day carving them into chunks and packs endless grab-and-go containers. In produce, we are constantly making secret stashes of overaged items around the store to avoid sending them back downstairs to the walk-in fridge and facing reprimand. It's obvious work, but shockingly satisfying, handling all those vegetables. In the way of service animals and Japanese cat hotels, I think stressed out and anxious New Yorkers should consider volunteer shifts in the produce aisle, letting all those leafy greens flood their parched cerebrums with calm. Likewise, center aisle grocery is all about fronting, pulling those bags of beet chips forward to present a smooth face for the customer. There's no biophilia or satisfaction here for me, but the work feels like it would appeal to the neatniks among us, those who reflexively square stacks of papers to align with the corners of their desk and or relax to a YouTube of Marie Kondo folding socks. A neurosis for every department, I suppose. I finished the day in the back room, washing tub after tub in the hot stainless steel sink. My glasses fog from the spray. Fish oils and stray parts spatter everywhere. I end exhausted, the ankles of my jeans soaked through at the exact point the rubbery apron cuts off. A few more spritzes to clean the sink itself, and I'm done. I bundle up the trash, lug it back to the giant yawning dumpsters, and then run for the locker room, a process that continues every day for the 2 months that I work there. One of the first things you realize working retail grocery is that people, in general, are hideous and insane, but their depravity almost miraculously balances out in the ledger of the day, so that aside from bruised feelings and egos, which never really balance, the store itself makes out just fine. You'll have a tiny little man who can barely see above the counter berating you to cut a slab of the $32.99 per pound king salmon into progressively smaller and smaller pieces, as if to prove some volumetric version of Archimedes' paradox, until you are left with reams of unsaleable king salmon that he promptly walks away from because you fucked it all up and that's not what he asked for at all. And then minutes later, an old woman with a blue beret and a Lakeshore lockjaw accent will eye the very mincemeat and declare she'll take it. When you double-check to make sure she realizes she's about to buy a pound of Wild King salmon ribbons at $32.99 per pound, she'll note curtly that while she does have children, there's nothing she adores more than her pet turtles, and no food is too dear for them. This actually happened, by the way, but don't let its veracity get in the way of the lesson. A grocery store is a finely tuned instrument to serve human whim, and the diversity of human whim often allows it to do double duty, serving one through the act of serving another. You also come to understand that unlike other professions, such as waiting tables or bartending, where you're confronted with the hideous and insane aspects of humanity, this will have no self-reflective benefit, whereupon you go through the rest of your life generously over-tipping the waitstaff of the world. This is partly because the particular demands you face in retail, or at least fishmongering at Whole Foods retail, are seemingly so idiosyncratic that you can't ever identify with them, much less imagine partaking in them. But more, because an inescapable part of the whole retail dynamic is an offer to step outside your normal self and get swept away imagining an enhanced version. Retail consultants never tire of discussing the three acts of sales, but the truth isn't in the structure as much as the setting. Retail is a performance, the very embodiment of some long caricatured avant-garde theater of the now, where rather than passive audience, you as person are cast as lead in a piece revolving around you as customer, targeted at you as financial instrument, and supported by a wide ensemble of living and non-living players out to solve your problems and satisfy your dreams. This is obviously amplified to metaphoric heights when shopping for clothes and twirling around in actual costumery, but playing dress-up is part of retail no matter where it happens, certainly occurring in grocery, where we don various diets and identities, ethical approaches and fantasies as hosts, guests, caretakers, and homemakers. Depending on the chain, employees are told to smile, to make eye contact, to wow, to smile, smile, smile. One manager repeatedly tells us, "We live in Yes Town," which he always clarifies by saying, "That means we never say no," in a way that makes him sound like even more of an imbecile than it makes us feel. We are told to apologize for any and every mistake, especially if it isn't our fault, unless, of course, the customer is complaining about injury or foodborne illness. Then we apologize for nothing. The charade ends, and we run to get a manager. If a customer is angry, Andy explains, you are calm. If they are saying something they think is smart, you are interested. And like theater, customer service comes with a script. During research, I come across retail prompt sheets with phrases to memorize and protocols for responding to various situations. Listen, rephrase, empathize, apologize, etc. With starter sentences and innumerable variations to address the full panoply of human neediness. In practice, however, it is very rarely, if ever, about memorizing lines. Instead, it's method acting, forcing a look of concern or suppressing a tick or involuntary reaction of annoyance. It is demonstrating empathy and combining that with an utterly welcome condescension. Think of customer service like how you would talk to a small child, one Whole Foods trainer explains. I pretend they are a little boy in elementary school I'm caring for. Andy gives us a secret phrase to use whenever we're stumped. Sounds important. It can be deployed almost universally to respond to questions we don't fully understand, hectoring we don't necessarily deserve, demands for advice we don't particularly have, and especially the long-winded rhapsodizing from lonely grandparents about children we don't at all know. At one point, he leads us in a chant. Sounds important, sounds important, sounds important. And the room fills with this customer service insight. We are judged for this. It's part of our official job description, and depending on the chain, determines raises, preferential shifts, and general position in the pecking order. Employees, we are told, are there only secondary to stock and work. Those functions could have been outsourced or mechanized yesterday. Primarily, we are there as forces of support, fellowship, community, and the all-important smile. That is our role. And while there is something animatronic and Stepford about the whole thing from a distance, I want to be clear. For the most part, this is nothing but a pleasure. The odd thing about being nice to people, even being forced to be nice to people, is that it is nice. This is not me, by the way, testifying from my completely dilettantish experiences, but the result of conversations with dozens of people over a wide spectrum of the retail food industry. In the middle of writing this book, the New York Times published an exposé of sorts about Trader Joe's employees. It discussed how employees at the famously cheerful chain were forced in some Disney-Dickensian mashup to smile and display enthusiasm, while underneath it all, they were secretly anxious about punishment. Their superiors might lash down on them if they slipped up. I don't doubt the Times found a few people willing to testify to that. Every field has disgruntled employees, and every employee has days where they feel annoyed, angry, and frustrated. But for the overwhelming number of people I talked with, being asked to smile and be nice to people didn't come close to tops in terms of a grievance. And there were grievances. Job security, nasty managers, choppy hours, low pay, gossip from fellow employees, you name it. At the big chains, they were hired precisely because that behavior came naturally to them. In fact, I'd say our willingness to buy what the Times is selling, to believe that we as customers are oppressing our retail smilers, speaks to an uneasy parallel dynamic going on inside each of us when we shop. Namely, there is something about the whole retail grocery experience that feels too good to be true. Something that makes us feel we should be oppressing someone to make it all make sense. And of course, that something is real. Actually, there are many somethings, but the fact that the person serving you gets through their own shift by alleviating their own stress with a smile that their manager has selected for during hiring and occasionally reminds them to give is absolutely not one of them. Walter's day begins at 4 a.m., creeping down the hallway of his parents' apartment in Flushing, Queens, while the rest of the house snores. He tries to get to bed by 9 p.m. on nights when he opens, but last night he couldn't fall asleep until just after midnight. This is typical. He only opens once or twice a week, so he never completely adjusts to any schedule. By 4:05, he's splashing water on his face in the small hallway bathroom. Then he gets the coffee going and picks up his phone, twisting in a pair of earbuds to listen to a track he laid down last night. Walter produces music. It's the side gig that he wants to make full-time once he gets out of grocery. He works with a variety of artists, most of whom he recruits from Whole Foods. The store is a village, and he hobnobs through the departments, making connections, giving daps and pounds, popping headphones over ears to offer samples. The steady turnover of employees ensures there is always someone new to collaborate with. Right now he's working with Derek, an aspiring rapper in cheese. It's pitch black out of the kitchen window as Walter drinks his coffee, and he bobs his head along to the beat he made for Derek. He'll share the track with him during one of their breaks, collect any critiques, then iron it all out after a shift back home. Now, here, Walter washes out his mug under the bright overheads of the kitchen, a kind of leave-no-trace ethic for his parents. He then returns to his room, picks up a tiny stubbed-out pinner joint, relights it, and takes a quick pull. The weed takes the edge off his fish counter work. What I've always thought of as irrepressible cheer is also slightly bloodshot and lifted. Makes me want to say hi to a couple hundred customers, he tells me. Hi, I'm Walter. I'm Mellow. Let me help you. Then he trots out of his apartment into the early morning darkness, the neighborhood gleaming, almost wet from the street lamps against the early morning emptiness, past the steamed-up window of the Curry Leaf, a late-night Malaysian spot where he occasionally gets breakfast, then up the covered staircase to the 7 train. By 6 a.m., he's at Whole Foods, in the employees' lounge, a dank cement room jammed with lockers and wire hangers. He sits on one of the rail benches, pulling on his rubber boots, strapping on a greasy apron still streaky with unsalable omega-3s from the night before. The earbuds come out for the first time all day. Like all long-term employees, he has a locker he's claimed for himself, and his civilian clothes get crushed inside. Then he punches in his 7-digit personal ID number and heads to the floor. At this hour, it's a shining vista. Long, empty aisles, glossy flooring, a blaze of saturated colors popping from the shelves, their riot contrasting with the regimented order of the product itself. Walter walks past it all, flicks on the lights at the fish counter, and picks up one of the 2 big snow shovels to begin laying down fresh ice. The ice in the case thaws out overnight, the edges thinning down like old teeth exposed by receding gums, and Walter's first job is to cover all that up with fresh flakes. Once the case is filled, he grabs the metal pans, arranging them like chalk outlines where the dead bodies of the fish will lie. The pans are secured into the ice with a big mallet, and for the next half hour, Walter's banging down on them, inserting each firmly into the ice. Then, once he gets the pans in, he starts laying down product. This involves racing back and forth from the giant walk-in freezer. Whole Foods management is no fool. They've figured out how much time an efficient opening takes, and so moving at a leisurely pace between tasks is not really an option. Every morning, no matter how expert he gets, by the time Walter begins stocking the case, there's a slight time crunch. So he multitasks, filling a giant stainless steel sink with warm water to thaw out the frozen fish until they resemble fresh, and ferrying the tubs with the fresh fillets to prep. With each run, he makes a quick check for bad product, accompanied via the sniff test, and sorts them out to match their price tags. Their work is a little like shingling a roof, slapping down the fish one by one in overlaying rows, each slightly on top of the other, so everything is tight and neat, and the counter comes to look a little like a fish itself, each fillet a scale. His fillets assembled, Walter begins to lay out the whole fish. Fins on, skin on, eyes bulging empty, curling them into the ice so the counter looks like a diorama they're swimming through. In the middle, like a grotesque centerpiece, he plops down a giant monkfish, a fish whose skin is starting to pull off from handling if you look at it too closely, but which is not designed to be looked at too closely. The monkfish's atmosphere, a freakish thing. Its mouth has been popped open, vicious teeth and burgundy gums channeling all the mysteries of the deep blue sea. Its presence announces that Whole Foods seafood is for real. By 7:30 a.m., the fish is largely out, and a second team member has arrived in support. Walter is now working on the value-added product. Although this is a fresh fish counter, fresh fish aren't where the money or the margin is. In some big-picture respects, the fresh fish are just slightly more saleable versions of that monkfish, triggering an association the store wants to sell. The appearance of a market where real food is bought, sold, maybe even if we squint, bartered for by gruff men with seafaring know-how on some off-screen pier. The profit, however, is in all that surrounds. At the fish counter, that means pre-cooked and ready-to-eat product. This is the tilapia, catfish, and steamed shrimp, aka the cheaper farm-raised stuff, that have been marinated in various attractive-looking oils and seasonings. Or the fish sticks, battered just sloppy enough to look home-style. Most of the pre-cooked is shipped in from a giant processing plant a few states away. That said, the seasoning is still done in-house, and so for the next 30 minutes, Walter's rooting around produce, making a bouquet of herbs, picking out a few shabby-looking peppers and a sunken onion, all of which he'll snip over the otherwise plain fillets to create a proper upsell. Walter's good at his job, and by 7:55 a.m., the case looks glorious. The garnishes arranged with the care of a florist, the food basically begging to be taken home and cooked, the result of pure technical skill by a man who can't afford to cook this seafood for himself. At 8 a.m., the store opens, and an initial flush of customers stream in. These are shoppers who have actually physically lined up for the opening, regulars with hardcore routines, an equal mix of the geriatric and the corporate gopher. They pulse through as soon as the doors slide open, instantly distributed like particles going into solution, so everything appears as it did moments before. The next hour continues this latency period. Then there's a slow, almost imperceptible increase in customers, as if the store is gradually awakening. By 10:30 a.m., you become aware there's been a shift. The store actually feels open now, with customers milling around, asking you occasional questions. This continues pleasantly enough for all of 20 minutes, just long enough to register, until suddenly you realize the number of customers is still increasing quite steadily, as if the day has a current of sorts, and actually you're headed towards rapids. And then it's bedlam, lunch hour, customers as locusts on the field, the aisles being ransacked, shelves pulled apart by young mothers with the righteous loathing of cops on a drug raid. At the fish counter, we're in continuous motion, the morning's organization flung around until the case is gappy, the fish themselves tattered, and the back counter a mess of stacked tubs and abandoned orders. The whole thing takes you from idle to under siege in a matter of minutes. And then, somewhere, way south, the rapids clear. It is over. We exhale and begin to put everything back in its place. It turns out there's an entire science to tracking these changes in customer foot traffic, along with a whole pimply contingent of consultants promising to model things to allow for more perfect staffing. It's euphemistically called human capital management, or just-in-time scheduling, and it applies the same glorious principles of logistics that brought efficiency into Lynn Ryle's world to the staffing decisions in retail. Thus, weekly schedules that in Joe Colomb's day were set in stone, ironed out as part of his business plan, are now adjusted on the fly, constantly, as the promise of high-speed computing and big data grind down on human resources. The grind. Human capital management, just-in-time scheduling, and lean supply chains all have their roots in 1950s Japanese automobile manufacturing. In many ways, they are beautiful, turning logistics into dance, where every movement has a purpose, impact, and precision, so the results achieve an actual grace. At the same time, their expansion from auto manufacturing to human resources shows just how punch drunk we've become by efficiency, just how loopy our collective moral compass has come to swing. But to see this, it helps to first understand the sheer magnitude of logistics it takes to construct a car. A typical automobile plant contains about 600 individual workstations, each of which involves a worker installing one of the 10,000 individual parts it takes to make a four-wheeler move. Even by the early 1920s, assembly lines were cranking out one new car every 24 seconds, or just over 1,600 new cars in a single 11-hour shift. The complexity here, in terms of parts per minute per station, should become mind-bogglingly clear to anyone who's ever depended on more than two back-to-back meetings running on time during a busy day. Suffice to say, getting the right one of those 10,000 pieces to the right workstation at the right time required a precision that needed to reoccur millions of times a day, every day. Too few parts and the line simply stopped. Too many and the factory was overburdened, the financial balance sheet bloated. In America, as we Americans do, auto manufacturers answered this complexity by erring on the side of extra. The inefficiency of too much was not just tolerated, it was seen as a strength. We had space, we had cash, and most important, we had a bulldozer-style optimism that insisted customers would buy all additional cars produced simply because we made them. Henry Ford's River Rouge plant was an actual kingdom with 16 million feet of factory floor and over 100 miles of interior railroad track. Ford brought in his own coal on his own barges, smelted his own steel in his own plants, and cast, cut, and machined those 10,000 parts to fit his own internally created gauge. Which is to say, he attacked the logistical nightmare of mass auto production by dislocating his jaw and swallowing it whole. A quest for perfect vertical integration, where we didn't go big, we made things simple. Homogenizing what was once a customizable product made by a small number of highly skilled generalist engineers into a single, unvarying form capable of being assembled by swarms of men, each skilled at exactly one 24-second motion. These two forces fed each other. Parts that were interchangeable were less of a burden to stockpile. Plants designed to make a single type of machine were capable of digesting raw materials far quicker. The result was nothing short of a revolution in production. Footnote. It's easy to sneer at the homogeneity and simplicity that Ford and other early mass producers worshipped, but in many ways it was intended as a gift to democracy. Prior to mass production, cars were crafted by hand, one by one, the exterior metal beaten into place by wooden mallets, while more technical work was accomplished in dozens of shops scattered around the city. The cars that emerged were unique, beautiful, and only for the filthy rich. Think about the market for satellites and supercomputers today. By first simplifying the car itself, Ford's ABC Darien march from Model A to T was all about streamlining his cars into something so simple anyone could fix them with regular household tools, sans mechanic, and then simplifying its production, he made the single most complex piece of technology of his era affordable for the average consumer. It was the first stab at a blueprint that has subsequently been followed for almost every modern convenience, from air conditioner to eyebobble, and that it has essentially built the expectation that the lifestyles and toys of the elite will be available to us all within a 10 to 15 year horizon. End footnote. None of this was possible in Japan. Geographically, there wasn't the same physical expanse or westward ho mentality. Geologically, Japan had limited natural resources, so vertical integration, tying together the coal, iron ore, barges, and smelting plants, was impossible. Financially, widespread post-World War II inflation prevented the type of liquidity needed to advance purchase and stockpile tens of thousands of discrete parts. And perhaps most trying, the Japanese consumer simply did not share the American preference for the monotonous, homogenized, and mass-produced, viewing the customizable and unique instead. These difficulties came to a head at the young Toyota Motor Corporation. Today, Toyota is the largest automaker in the world. In 1950, it was a small, family-run business that had made a name for itself modernizing wooden looms with combustion engines. The loom business was small and shrinking, and so Toyota decided to expand its work into the more powerful engines of cars. And for all the reasons listed above, Toyota was floundering. The company was heavily in debt. Forced layoffs led to workers who were perpetually striking. The quality of the few cars it was actually producing was low. In one of those odd, looping historical moments, one of the head engineers at Toyota, Taichi Ono, went to the United States on an R&D junket to visit automobile factories. This was 1956, and somewhere between stops on his trip, he stumbled into an American supermarket. Like those shrieking Italian women, he was stunned by the abundance. Nothing similar existed in Japan. But rather than the food, his engineer eyes were drawn to a different delight, the workflow. Women walked from station to station, taking exactly what they needed. And as the items came off the shelf, they were replaced by stock boys, exactly as space allowed. In a flash, he saw it all as supermarket pioneer Clarence Saunders had, an inverted assembly line, where the goods stay in place and the customer trolleys forth, building a basket. Yet, in contrast to the assembly lines he was used to, piled with excess inventory, a woman on the supermarket floor was confronted only with the items she wanted. Standing there, soaking it in, Ohono had a vision. An auto plant where the worker operated with the same efficiency a supermarket offered its shopper. Parts would be available just in the time they were wanted. It would take another generation and almost 20 more years for this vision to mature, but just in time would eventually become the first of Toyota's responses to the American way of mass production. Just in time demanded a simultaneously tighter, yet more flexible coupling of the pieces of the supply chain, emphasizing communication over conformity. It relied on cooperative problem solving with suppliers to ensure they shipped only what was needed when it was needed. And it applied a relentless, obsessive scrutiny to all forms of waste. It would evolve from physical adjustments to the manufacturing process, like red Kanban cards handed backwards at each stage of production, to the electronic flags and integrated robotics of today. In the process, it made Toyota the most profitable automaker in the world. Its net margins grew to be over 8 times higher than the industry average. These practices made their way to retail slowly, even as their eventual application was impossible to resist. For instance, managing inventory is one of the oldest, most central problems for any grocer. If your buyers purchase too much, you are losing money for all the obvious reasons. Those cluttered racks of 70% off markdowns, crates of near-rotten vegetables hauled off to the food bank. If you have too little, on the other hand, you're losing opportunity, the products that aren't sold because they weren't there to begin with. Given the tens of thousands of SKUs at even a modest grocery store and the need to forecast completely fickle customer demand, the logistical problems faced are even more extreme than those faced by Toyota. When America, like a bunch of carbonated lemmings, decides to jump off the seltzer cliff and you don't have enough LaCroix in your warehouse because your buyer wasn't quite sure how much to advance purchase, nothing immediate changes on the balance sheet. But instead of minting money on each sale of sparkling, every day contains a shadow loss, all the more painful because you likely don't even notice it. There is no magic way to eliminate this tension, but just-in-time and its descendants gave retailers new, more powerful tools to negotiate it. But somewhere in the last 10 years, just-in-time manufacturing morphed into just-in-time scheduling, whereupon the glorious terminology of efficiency squats square on the face of the retail worker. Again, the allure is unavoidable. For years, scheduling was done with all the nuance of mass production. Staff orders were placed and then rarely readjusted. Lead time for an employee receiving their schedule might be as long as a month. Humane if you have childcare to arrange and a life to enjoy, but almost geologically slow in a world accustomed to minute-to-minute supply adjustments. To correct this ineffectuality, a slew of consultants rushed into the space, crowing about optimized schedule generation based on customer demand, variable scheduling, and advanced labor forecasting, phrases that seem to glaze the ear harmlessly, the same waxy consultant speak that's been dulling us for decades, but which upon reflection are simply sinister, applying the principles that worked so well for auto parts to human beings, desperately needed when in demand, yet obnoxious waste when piled up behind the counter with no customers to serve. In practice, this involves swapping the standard weekly work schedule for something entirely tentative, often just a printed list of days when an employee may or may not be needed. The employee then learns via email, text, or call when or whether to physically report to work, HR Daily Advisor, a chirpy blog on the subject, explains. Similarly, an employee may arrive at work to discover that whatever off-site devices are forecasting customer demand have decided today will be slow and get sent home with the explanation their shift has ended early. Sadly for management, humans tend to react differently than automobile parts when ripped from one place to another according to algorithmic whim. Happily for management, norms are such that low-wage workers can be replaced almost as easily as automobile parts if they complain much more than the metal. You're supposed to get the schedule 2 weeks ahead, Walter tells me. I can't remember a single time in my 6 years that ever happened. And if it did happen, it would change the following week. Usually we get the schedule 2 days ahead. A lot of team members have to call in to find out if they're working. It's certainly a lean efficiency, whittling employees on both ends, limiting the number of hours they get, thus pushing more and more into part-time work, yet destroying the ability to take on a second job since they have no set schedule for a second employer to work around. The diminished hours often make it easier to promise valuable benefits during hiring, but then hold them just out of reach in practice, available only, say, for workers who clock the magical 30 hours a week required. And thankfully, there's some machine crunching the numbers to optimize the precise logistics of keeping that in check. One study found that workers in these conditions had hours that varied month to month from usual by almost 50%, which of course also means their wages varied by that much as well. Another found that 60% of retail workers said they needed to be available to fulfill every work schedule that might be assigned in a given week, and that a full third of all retail employees get less than 24 hours notice for schedule changes. There are professions where we expect people to be on call, doctors, first responders, but they're compensated for that, both financially and in civic respect. Retail workers are simply not. Footnote. Note on sunshine and lack thereof. These are all ways efficiency is brought to bear on consumer-facing employees. Suffice to say, the exact same dynamics bear down in an even more oppressive fashion on those low-wage employees who operate behind the scenes. It is not hyperbole to say there is a concerted effort to turn the low-wage employees of the world's warehouses into real, mostly living cyborgs, leveraging the fine-tuned muscle control of human fingers with the immediate feedback and surveillance of computing systems. This merger, once minute to minute, now second to second, is entirely to service the goal of accelerating their ability to fetch, wrap, and box products. These employees already have computers strapped to their bodies, pushing them to carry out repetitive tasks as fast as possible, tracking their performance in a manner that can be tied directly to their pay scale. But the tracking being done now is with first-generation tech. Amazon, leader in all things warehouse and efficiency, recently patented a wristband that gives haptic feedback as it tracks workers' hand motions, vibrating to nudge them if they fall behind, alerting them if they stray from the optimal path to, say, scratch an itch. It is a technological integration that might finally be tight enough to choke out everything extraneous and ennobling that could get in the way of box fetching. And yes, a third generation of tech, where haptic feedback turns biochemical via nootropics and/or low side effect stimulants, does not strike me as hysterical or implausible or anything except a natural progression, possibly even welcomed by a certain self-immolating work-as-life contingent in Silicon Valley. End footnote. The cultural effects of this shift cannot be underestimated. Retail and service sector jobs have always been marked by petty managers and their indiscriminate hiring and firing. And scheduling abuses come part and parcel with low skills and wages in every sector. But just-in-time automates all that. It gives the most callous decisions the imprimatur of technology, offering not just individual deniability, but an actual halo of progress, where literal dehumanization, i.e. treating people like parts, can be justified as valuable for the team. And in doing so, it slowly shifts expectations across the board. When I worked at Whole Foods, for instance, just-in-time scheduling did not officially exist in nomenclature. But the rapid scheduling changes, the short notice, the sudden demands on time were still very real. They were often against official policy as preached to us by Andy on day one and day two of orientation. But then they were often relayed to us in the exact same language of efficiency, team play, and smart decision-making that defined his lectures. Most important, we on the floor knew and discussed the realities of the competition. Target, Starbucks, Walmart, and all the other nearby retailers who explicitly used just-in-time. And those conversations flavored the coercion. A soft demand to be a team player was always in reference to how much worse it could be out there if we were ever unlucky enough to do something that would force someone to ask us to play for a different team. Or as Walter says, nobody wants to say anything because they feel like their team leaders are going to get them in trouble. They might pull up your lateness from the last 4 months, or if they don't have your lateness, maybe they'll go over your food safety logs. All these things that don't really matter until you complain, and then they matter. Which bleeds into a larger question. As an employee, Walter's sharp. Unlike almost everyone else I work with at Seafood, he knows where the fish comes from and can pay lip service to the different ethical regimes that are advertised endlessly as guarantors of wholesomeness. This is a natural accumulation of knowledge from working the front, earnestly answering questions, the slow development of expertise. In a different era of America, Walter, even without his college degree, would rise through the ranks based on his endless energy, enthusiasm, and willingness to do just about anything asked. Yet, in our current era, his fate at Whole Foods seems like an open question. He receives regular raises, but they bump him up by literal nickels and dimes, not into meaningful money for the New York he lives in. And thus, while the vocabulary around his title might change from team member to supervisory team member, he basically stays in the same place. And the entire experience has embittered him. The reality of Whole Foods is that its myth of abundance and efficiency is based on the idea that there are an abundance of Walters out there, willing to pour 6 years of their life into a $15 per hour job, yet remain cheerful, eager, ready to serve all that virtuous food to those who can pay. My experience is there is an abundance of labor. I went to 3 different Whole Foods hiring sessions, and each one was packed with hopeful applicants. But that does not translate into an abundance of Walters. Unfortunately for Whole Foods, they don't seem to care about the distinction. Payroll costs are an immediate, identifiable flag to any consultant worth their MBA. While the faint aura of having a Walter behind the counter instead of a clueless, replaceable me is something built and lost over time, it isn't intangible. It just often evades eyes whose financial pupils have shrunk from long hours staring at spreadsheets and can no longer see qualities that do not have clear metrics attached to them. They also likely assume Walter's capacity can be trained in others for less than it takes to retain him. Footnote. This particular point is wrong. Perhaps most critically from an economic perspective, research again and again shows that spending on payroll results in increasing sales. For instance, one 2006 study of 500 retail stores found that every $1 increase in payroll resulted in $3.81 in increased margin. However, its persistence, in spite of the research, is not accidental and alludes to the larger question of the title heading. Is this quest for efficiency always a race to the bottom? Or are there equilibrium points whereby efficiency and outcompeting your rival can coincide with dignity? This is not a moral question, even as our general way of life may hinge on the answer. It is a question about optimization and consumer habits and how exactly the shoppers who purchase from Whole Foods make their purchasing decisions. It is also a question in which my generation of MBAs, both incentivized to find quick earning fixes and insulated from the actual work of retail in a way that transforms abstraction into condescension, may not even be interested in considering. Conventional wisdom on retail staffing runs hard, and thus, whether it's necessary or not, staffing is seen as a cost to be cut rather than a community to be built, and an actual human matrix of voices and values that could represent the heart of a brand are overlooked in favor of more easily quantifiable attributes like real estate, merchandising, and advertising. End footnote. Walter knows this and has grown sour on the chain. Our last conversations are filled with how much Whole Foods has changed, how his health insurance and the slightly above average pay that he has ground out prevent him from easily leaving, even as he feels completely ground down by management. When I ask him if he feels like he has any job security, he says, "No, it frustrates me. It wears on me. I've worked here 6 years. I got no security. I work hard, so I'd like to know I have a place as long as things are going right." I don't feel that way. Not at all. I feel like they might cut me at any moment. On a different night, I close with him. We pull in the seafood, a dramatically quicker process than banging down all those pans to open, tossing fish into tubs, washing down the pans with a high-velocity spray nozzle, all wrapped in less than 30 minutes. Then it is back to the locker room and the 7 train. I leave him at the Flushing stop a little after 1 a.m. Because of a scheduling change, almost certainly against Whole Foods policy, he has the morning shift tomorrow. Rather than waking at 4 a.m., he can sleep in slightly, maybe until 6:30, he tells me. He'll be the employee who comes in at 7:30 to help prep the ready-to-cook section, back at the fish counter, strapping on the apron, ready to do it all over again. Then one day, I'm working with Lawrence, a West African who commutes an hour and a half from the Bronx and my favorite person to close with since he's all business and willing to start pulling product a good 15 minutes before closing rather than the 5 we're officially supposed to. When Andy walks up to us, "Lawrence, I just wanted to find you. It has been a pleasure," Andy says with a face as smiling and upbeat as our first day of orientation. "Today is my last day as a member of the Whole Foods team." For a second, his smile drops, and then from the customer side of the fish counter, Andy offers a clumsy handshake that has to negotiate the rise between us. Lawrence laughs long and hard at this. "I'll miss you, man. You're the best trainer ever. I don't think this place can survive." Andy nods and walks off, heading at a slightly dizzy pace toward the customer service desk, while Lawrence looks over at me. Andy is such a funny guy, always such a joker. I'm squeegeeing the floor. "Andy's never gonna leave. He loves this place," he continues. But Lawrence is wrong, and Andy is out. Whole Foods has let him go. They're working on a new, more efficient way of training employees, and his position has been restructured. And so, the single most enthusiastic person, the truest true believer I met in my time in retail, the guy whose answer to everything was just work harder and trust that things will work out, has found exactly whom to trust and exactly how hard things can work out.